CBSI in the world. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine crisis. A piece of the Ukraine crisis is the energy necessary for Germany and the EU to conduct a recovery from the pandemic, from what is apparently a recession before all of us worldwide, price instability and the threat of joblessness. However, right now what we have is a very peculiar headline from Reuters. Scholz, that would be Chancellor Scholz of all the Germans, to visit Nord Stream 1 gas turbine in Germany. The explanation. A Nord Stream 1 gas turbine that has become the focus of a deepening energy row with Russia is in Germany after undergoing maintenance in Canada. Russia has cited problems with the turbine as the reason for cutting gas supply via Nord Stream 1. Gregory, this is most peculiar. Germany needs energy. It doesn't have adequate energy supplies for the winter. Now we're told because Nord Stream 1 has been offline for some days, they have not stored up enough to get through a difficult period ahead. This is one version of Europe responding to the Russian energy weapon. On Moscow's part, did they always plan to use the energy weapon? What is your reading of Moscow? Because right now, the focus is not on the battlefield in Donbass. It's on what is Berlin going to do?
Yes, I think that Germany always knew that it had an important role it could play in Western Europe's energy markets. It, I believe, originally came into that marketplace thinking that it was going to be integrated into Russia, was going to be integrated into the Western and Eastern European economics scenes seamlessly with the end of the Cold War in 1991. But the reality was that as Western Europe went ahead and became more dependent on Russian energy and at the same time less willing to integrate Russia into the Western economics because Russia represented a different social model to the West, even though Russia was now post-Soviet and anti-communist. So Russia increasingly had to think, well, look, you know, at least they can't do without us, so they can't push us around too much. And it was almost – and Trump saw that when he was over there and criticized the Germans for their incredible overdependence on Russian oil and gas. So we're in a situation now where Germany, under Merkel and under the socialists, have successive governments who have not paid attention to a serious energy strategy. They've abandoned their nuclear power generation. They have not made plans for proper modernization, if you like, of their conventional hydrocarbon power generation. And they haven't certainly done anything like what was necessary to create alternatives from non-traditional energy sources. So Germany is and has continued, even when this problem was pointed out to it, has continued to refuse to stabilize its situation. It even went along when the Ukraine war began with the United States in voluntarily cutting dependence on some Russian oil and gas. And that's now clearly not going to work. So Russia has to play a role in Germany's energy future, or Germany will suffer this winter with some massive political and social repercussions.
What we have, though, in Germany is a version of all of the EU. There's no prime minister in Italy, none, until the elections late in September. And that itself is not going necessarily go to someone who is uniting with the defense of Ukraine. There's no prime minister in London. There's a contest now about who can cut taxes more or earlier. The president in France is qualified by the election of the legislature supported by Marie Le Pen, who is not unfriendly with Moscow. You know all this, Gregory. So what we have now is a difficulty to plan ahead because Europe doesn't have energy for winter. Now, the other side of this, is there a plan B if the allied forces, that would be NATO, stand down in Ukraine and say, listen, Ukraine, we can't fight to the last shivering poor person in Pomerania?
Well, there's no question about it. This completely overshadows the war in Ukraine, which was all about the great gung-ho spirit of people in the streets rallying behind poor little Ukraine. Now, they'll forget poor little Ukraine in a heartbeat and start to figure out what's necessary to keep the heating going throughout Western Europe. France, of course, is in a better position than Germany and most other people in Western Europe. But the reality is that every Western European country, as well as Britain, are going to have to start modernizing their approach toward energy. Theoretically, the United States should be part of that equation too. It promised some of its fuel reserves, its emergency fuel reserves, to keep Germany in fuel over this winter. But the U.S., frankly, doesn't have enough power to spare for that. And the U.S. should be reverting back to its policies of the Trump administration of opening up domestic oil and gas exploration and production. But it's not going to do it. So the United States is going to suffer. The global energy price levels are going to remain high. That's going to help not only the Middle Eastern states, but it'll help Russia as well as an energy exporter. Germany will be limited in its ability to assist Ukraine and to coerce Russia. So the reality is that this will have a dramatic impact on the Ukraine war. In other words, Russia will consolidate its position in the east, down through the Donbass and through the Crimea and the like, and that will become, if you like, a fairly settled Russian victory on the east of Ukraine. Ukraine itself will have to be content with a buffer state situation. It can come out of that very, very well economically if it chooses, and it will play on the guilt of the West by saying, look, you weren't able to save us, so you now owe us, and you'll have to rebuild Western Ukraine, which the West probably will, to a large degree, do. But the end of the story, as we forecast many months ago on this program, is that Russia comes out dominating Eastern Ukraine and therefore dominating the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea routes. Western Ukraine remains a buffer state with perhaps increased aid and the like from the West, but not as a member of NATO. And the European markets go back to depending to a degree on Russian oil and gas. So what has all this achieved? Why did the Biden administration push for a conflict between Russia and Ukraine to galvanize this situation? It hasn't achieved anything other than to drive Russia into the arms of the PRC and to create this new Eurasian bloc of Russia, People's Republic of China, and Iran. Doesn't help us any. We saw a revived political interest in the momentum of NATO, but no real momentum towards the improvement of NATO back into a military alliance. We see Turkey now once again left out in the cold and debating how it will secure its future, either with NATO or against NATO, and it'll probably start to initiate a crisis against Greece in the coming months. All of these things are coming out of this ill-conceived approach to driving the world into this Ukraine-Russia conflict.
What is the talk then? Because I've had it confirmed in Washington. What is the talk of deploying F-16s to Ukraine or other warplanes from the NATO arsenal? Is that just braggadocio, or does NATO now contemplate that it must go on the offensive?
Well, if it does, it's taking a very high-risk approach to things, and it still hasn't considered what its end goal is likely to be. What would it achieve by putting F-16s into Ukraine? Frankly, one of the things we've seen from both sides, from both the Russian side and the Ukrainian side, is that that conventional air power is very hard to sustain in a contested air defense environment. So the US or the NATO forces with deploying the F-16s could find themselves in a degree of difficulty. They make a mistake by saying that they're going to do that because they think it might intimidate the Russians. But if they're forced to do it, then they've escalated the risk factor enormously without any end goal in sight.
What is the advantage that Russia will gain from securing the Donbass and, what you'd have to say, aggrandizing NATO, the addition of Sweden and Finland, the talk about F-35s deployed to Poland? Has Russia gained from this, or is everybody a loser?
I think everybody's a loser to some degree, and NATO is certainly not gaining. I mean, adding Sweden and Finland to, as members of NATO is like adding more gold braid to the uniform of a retired field marshal. It doesn't really make any difference to his performance, because the reality is that NATO has transformed from being a very, very efficient military alliance of the 1980s into being a very poor military alliance today, and one which is now just a political alliance, one which is has a lot of rhetoric at an official level, but really does not have capable and interoperable forces. The good news is that that while NATO is militarily weak and uncoordinated, so too is Russia. Both of them have limited resources and a limited will, frankly, to fight. And even more importantly, a limited need to fight. There is no great ideological threat to either side now, either the Russian side or to the NATO side, because the reality is that neither side is looking at great territorial aggrandizement. Certainly NATO expanded, but it wasn't to the benefit, if you like, of a bloc intended to overthrow Russia or the former Soviet Union. That's done and gone. Russia is not really looking to take over Poland. It's probably not even seriously looking at any stage for the next few decades, at least, of anything to do about regaining reach into the Baltic Sea. So basically, the threat's not there, the opportunity's not there, the costs would be there if either side did anything, and yet both sides find it difficult to step back and to trust. And then you've got people who have a professional commitment to jingoism, like the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, who basically has transformed the traditional role of Secretary General of NATO from one of coordinating the policies decided by the member states into being one of warmongering directly. And all of a sudden you have a very confused strategic situation.
Gregory Copley, the editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. Outstanding is the Islamic Republic of Iran and its suspect nuclear weapons program. When we come back, I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.